But Andre, you were talking about learning more about emptiness. I listened to the book by the Dalai Lama today, The Essence of the Heart Sutra, and that really brought out a lot of the things that I had been questioning about understanding emptiness and shunyata. That might be worth a listen.
Yeah, absolutely. Where did you get that again? What was
Audible has a thing now to where you can stream books as long as you're a member, and it's this big catalog, and that was one of them, and I got to listen to it for free, and it's like 3 hours and some change long.
Is that right?
It was really good.
Yeah, and this is Audible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm not familiar with Audible because I'm a dinosaur. So what do you? what is that again?
It's a service that you can buy and subscribe to audiobooks, which is the way I listen. I can't read. I have to listen.
You have to listen. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That might be worth a shot. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Hey, all, I'm going to share our little announcement screen for a little bit. So. And take a minute just to remind you all that we have, besides tonight, tomorrow will be a break. And, oh, this is going too fast. And I'm going to stop sharing it. That's going too fast. Tomorrow is a break. And then on the weekend, Don will be teaching on the Bodhisattva Jewel Garland, which is a text that I don't remember having a teaching on it at the Kadampa Center, although we might have had something in my early years that I'd forgotten about. And this is about how to live with compassion. Also, just a reminder that sponsorships are available, and it's helpful to us to have them. And if you sponsor, you know, we invite you to also write a dedication, and we'll post that and share it with everybody.
Mm-hmm. Donna, when I was looking at the website about the weekend session, mm-hmm. are there two separate sessions, or is it like a repeat on the second one? Are all of them different?
It's three different sessions. So, we do this regularly with visiting teachers, where we'll have a weekend workshop that starts on Friday night. And then, sorry, I'm trying to
Publish
this thing to the web too. I'll come back so I can pay attention to what I'm saying. We start on Friday night, and then it'll continue on Saturday and Sunday. But they're all separate sessions. So it's building on it. But if you're not able to come to one of it, you know, do come to whatever you can. So, John is here.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening, John.
Hey, John.
Good to see you all.
Good to see you.
Okay. So, I think we can go ahead and start, unless, did you want to wait another minute or so, Donna, or how are you feeling?
No, I think we can go ahead.
Okay.
All right.
I'll let you start.
All right, let me go find the prayers. All right, let's start with a seven-limb prayer. Let's do it in English tonight. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. And let's say the refuge in bodhicitta once in English and twice in Tibetan. I go for refuge until I am enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Sangye chedang so ki chognam la chang chu bardu dagni kyab su chi dagi chun yen gi pe sonam gi drola pinshir sangye drupar shog. Sangye chedang so ki chognam la Changchu Baru Dagni Kyapsu Chi Dagi Chunyen Gi Pe Sonam Gi Drola Pinshir Sange Drupar Sho.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you, Donna, for leading the prayers. So, as usual, I like to start with just a short meditation, give ourselves a chance to focus the mind a bit, calm the thoughts a bit, and then on the basis of a bit calmer mind, we'll set our motivation together, as well as do a short exploration of this topic for tonight, kind of how do we find sanity in the midst of difficult times. You know, the description for this and that I given to Donna had political climate, but it's everything. It's, you know, what we're dealing with in terms of this pandemic, what we're dealing with in terms of social injustice issues, so many different things that are going on in our world right now, climate change, all these haven't gone away that are still there. So we're going to be kind of exploring this a little bit in the meditation and then funnel that into our motivation for being here. So the first few minutes we're just going to do in silent meditation on the breath. And no doubt most of you have some way that you already work with the breath to calm the mind, to focus the mind. But if you need a suggestion, if you're new to meditation or just would like a suggestion for tonight, I generally suggest this area around the nostrils as you're breathing in and out through the nose. There's a very subtle sensation that occurs in that area. Make that your meditation object and try to stay present with it, not following the breath into the body and following the breath out of the body, but rather just staying there, kind of like you're posted right there. Your attention is supposed to kind of abide there. And then any time that the mind wanders, of course, we check in occasionally and we see what the quality of our meditation is. And if we see that the mind has gotten distracted, which it's prone to do, you know, if we're making grocery lists in our head or various things come into our minds, or we might get distracted by sounds in the space that we're in or whatever the case might be. And when that's happened, there's no need for any judgment. We're simply training our minds to be focused. So we let go of whatever it was that distracted us and return to the breath at that time. So I'm going to ring the chime and we'll start just a short period of silent meditation. And you can do this again on your own for these couple of minutes, and then I'll come in and I'll lead you in a short reflection on the topic for tonight, as well as setting our motivation. So now to do this short exploration before we set our motivation for tonight, I'd like you to choose something that is going on in our world that you find very trying yourself, perhaps the thing you find most trying, whether it be, again, the political environment, what's going on there, what's happened around coronavirus, climate change, issues of social justice, particularly with regard to race, that are going on in this country right now. I mean, so many different things. And we may even have other things that are just trying in our lives that are more specific to us and not a part of the world around us. But choose whatever it is that you feel is most trying for you, the most challenging thing in your life right now. And just settle on that first, and then I'll lead you in a few questions. So with whatever it is that you've chosen, invariably there is something happening on the outside world that is a part of the equation. But what I'd like you to do in this short investigation is first to look at what is happening in the inner world. How are we looking at that situation? What thoughts do you bring to your working with it that cause it to be so trying and so difficult for you? And here, just let your mind sort of free float and see what comes up. What are the thoughts that you have, the ways that you are looking at that situation that influence your inability to bear it, the difficulty you're having with it, how you see it as trying? One thing I might invite you to do is when you get an answer, maybe see if there's a deeper answer. Yeah, sometimes what comes up first might be a little bit more superficial, but just keep asking that question and seeing if you can get to the root of why you are having this particular thing as trying. How are you looking at it that influences that? And then one other thing I'd like to invite you to do is to think about the fact that, again, if this is a world situation or even if it's an individual situation, there are no doubt others that are experiencing this as well but are not seeing it as quite so trying. For them, it may not be quite as difficult. Can you imagine the way that they are looking at it that is causing them to not have the same sort of consternation that you're having around that issue? Just to entertain that possibility of what might other people be thinking in their perspective and their viewing that is causing them not to see it perhaps as trying as what you are. And just spend a minute or two investigating that idea. And then lastly, I'd like you to kind of examine the idea that you could change your own thoughts about that situation, about that trying thing in our world, based on seeing how others might not see it quite as trying, or even other positive ideas that you might have. Just entertain that idea and see what would it be like to look at that problem, that difficulty, these trying times, the challenges that you're facing with that, in a slightly different light, or maybe a radically different light, one where you actually even see it as something beneficial. Is that possible? Again, just explore that idea of having a change, a shift in the way that you are looking at that. And then to move this into setting our motivation for tonight, just through this investigation, we've already seen the degree to which how we look at things can potentially have an effect on how we react to them, how we experience them. So maybe set the motivation initially to explore this for your own welfare, recognizing that if you're able to work with the difficult circumstances of our trying times, in a different way, perhaps they won't be quite so trying. Perhaps they won't be quite so difficult. But moreover, we could maybe make something really positive out of this, something that helps us to increase our awareness and connection to others, our ability to benefit them. And so kind of bringing both of those levels of motivation to tonight, the willingness to work on looking at this idea of staying sane in trying times through the perspective of the benefit that you will accrue from this, but moreover, so that you can also help others, seeing how we are all connected in this world, how we are all in this together, as we hear so often these days, and generating the motivation to be here for other beings as well as yourself. Okay, so good evening. Welcome to this talk tonight and this exploration of this topic. Of course, this is a very, I don't know this title. I think I even stole this title from a talk that Venerable Rabina gave. Venerable Rabina does these talks in her own manner. I'm going to be pulling in a few different things that I've come across in various sources and use them as the platform for discussing a lot of ideas. But already we saw in just the meditation that the main focus and the impetus of what we're looking at tonight, although it will involve some level of action, because I don't think that we need to just sit in our little, you know, caves and change our minds, and that's entirely our job. It's to change our minds first, and then on the basis of how we've changed our minds, to act more responsibly in the world. I love that word responsibly, because it entails the word response. I mean, how do we actually respond to what's going on rather than react and from our habitual places? So this is what we're going to be exploring tonight, and I hope you find it useful. One thing that I want to share in terms of the slides that I have, the very first slide for tonight is a quote that actually came up on my Facebook feed one of the times when I did this talk for another audience, another center, and I thought it was such a wonderful quote that went so well with these teachings. And this was from Rinpoche back in June of 2018. He said, "Every day is a very important time for us. Very important, every hour, minute, very important what we are going to do, what we do, how we think. It is so important to not make mistakes, always to put your effort in what is the best thing to do." And of course, this is really central in a typical Rinpoche kind of way of how we actually go about working with the Buddha's teachings and working with an understanding of them, is that there's essentially, you know, Buddhism is a 24/7 kind of deal. And, you know, we do have to continually look at how are we acting and how are we thinking that are sort of guiding our actions, the thoughts that get behind our actions and cause us to do various things, and whether we continually react to things with our habitual patterns of thinking, or whether we actually, as I said earlier, respond to things much more effectively. And of course, this is the challenge of this world, and this is the challenge of these times in particular. I mean, it seems like almost every time I do this talk, it becomes a little more relevant. I think the first time I did it was after the 2016 election. And again, even though this talk was framed in terms of the political climate, it's not taking any kind of political sides. I mean, you might get clear when you listen to me talk that I've got a particular orientation from my own perspective, but we're trying to embrace some concepts and ideas that will help us regardless of which side of the political sense we're on, or if we're in the middle, or if we're, you know, maybe not in the political arena at all. It will also hopefully help us to deal with whatever is going on, because we're all being impacted in much more profound ways, certainly by the pandemic that's going on. Climate change, of course, is having huge impacts on our world. We see the, you know, Hurricane Laura heading towards the Texas, Louisiana coast, and, you know, Category 4 now. I mean, you have all these like things going on in the world on top of other things. And we're getting to a point where the times do become very, very trying, very difficult. So I'm hoping I can approach it from that vantage point of, you know, how do we use the Buddha's wisdom and teachings and an understanding of how we work with our minds, and then how do we act from that? How do we actually make sure that our response to what's going on in our world is effective? And of course, this is a challenge. All of the Buddhist teachings are challenges. I went through this a little bit last night in terms of, you know, we got a number of different tools and things to work with from a sutra perspective, from a tantric perspective. Tonight, we're mostly going to focus on some different ways that I've identified that are useful for me in working with trying times. And I'll put the outline up and kind of give you an idea of that. This has evolved over time. Just so you know, if you go back and you watch like a talk I did on this topic back in 2016, it's going to look very different than what it looks like now. I've gotten away from maybe some of the political content, but nonetheless, I think I brought in some teachings that are really quite useful. So I hope, again, that this will be of some benefit. The very first topic that we're going to look at is this whole idea that we explored a little bit in the meditation, shifting your perspective. Of course, this is such a key and central element of Buddhist teachings and Buddhist practice, but I'm going to primarily use as sort of the starting point the fact that perspective was one of the eight pillars of joy in this amazing book called The Book of Joy that His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu had a dialogue back in about 5 years ago, I guess around 2015, around His Holiness's 80th birthday. They met in Dharamsala and they had this wonderful little dialogue, and a man named Douglas Abrams was there to capture all of that. He put it all into a book using the words of these two revered spiritual masters to guide us through their advice for how to live and how to have a more joyous life in the space of all the things that are going on. So the very first of the eight pillars that they chose was this idea of perspective. My perspective is kind of, again, what we were exploring in the meditation. How are we viewing things? How are we looking at things? You know, we do all have a particular perspective that is there primarily due to our own conditioning. You know, and whether we talk about past lives, which Buddhism holds to, or just this life, we can see how much conditioning plays a role. We have a lot of conditioning, of course, that when we talk about the political arena, that goes on in terms of our media. And I'm not going to get into, you know, any sort of, you know, judgment of the media, but rather the acknowledgement. I think it was even, I've seen this before, but one of my friends on Facebook posted that little graph that shows where different media fit in terms of where they are more liberal leaning or more conservative leaning or towards the middle. But we do get impacted by a lot of things in our lives that influence how we look at things. This is our perspective. This is our sort of worldview. And again, I'm not saying that you have to throw any of that out necessarily. It's just we want to take a closer look at all of that and see to what extent has our perspective taken on dimensions that are more beneficial and more helpful to ourselves and to others versus the perspective we sometimes have towards these trying times that lead us to getting angry, upset, that, you know, cause us to lose sleep at night, whatever the case might be. So this is the idea behind that very first topic that we'll get into now. And I'll go back to the slides just to begin some of that discussion. Then I have a few more topics that come mostly from our idea of Buddhist practice and kind of how we incorporate some of that. Having worked with those first three that are all about our thoughts and our minds, I want to then talk a little bit about something that starts off as mental, which is hope. And hope is kind of a weird word because we don't talk about it so much in Buddhism, but nonetheless, I'm going to use an idea of how we work with hope that I've obtained from a wonderful book called Active Hope by Joanna Macy and Chris Johnston, and I'll talk more about that later. But then how does that drive us into action? You know, how do we actually act from that place that is, in a sense, the culmination of our shift in perspective that we're entertaining through this first part? To start this off, I've got a quote from, of course, a non-Buddhist, a Jewish man, Viktor Frankl, who many of you know, wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning. And he spent years in concentration camps in Nazi Germany. Well, actually, it was in Poland, I think, primarily. But anyway, he was in the Nazi occupation. And it says here, everything can be taken from a man, from a person, but one thing. The last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. And this is the gist of this idea of perspective, is that we all have the freedom to choose at any time how we are going to look at something. You know, we can fall into, once more, our habitual patterns and look at it through that lens of, oh, this is too horrible and I can't deal with this and therefore I'm going to, like, you know, binge on Netflix and, you know, eat too much food and sleep too much and do whatever to try to escape from it. Or we can choose a perspective that actually looks at this slightly differently and maybe sees it as a challenge but nonetheless an opportunity as well. And so this shifting of our perspective, it's really up to us. You know, we all have control over that. And this is what was amazing about Viktor Frankl, his life story, was that what allowed him to survive in the concentration camps that he said many people didn't have, and they fell prey to their own depression and eventually death, was that he tried to keep this perspective of why he was there, some sort of meaning, some sort of purpose that guided him, that made all of that meaningful, that gave great purpose to his stay there so that he could then continue on doing the work, doing what needs to be done. And that's, of course, the problem with these trying times, is that they sometimes act as obstacles to us. They stop us in our tracks, and we almost feel like we're even allowed to do a timeout at those, although Buddhism is 24/7, we kind of get a break when things are too trying for us. Okay, well, it's just gotten over the top, and I'm going to do whatever I need to do to survive. And we end up doing things and possibly saying things that we regret. So everything is grist for the mill, as they say. Everything is an opportunity to work with. It's just in particularly trying times, it's challenging. I mean, I've been challenged in my own ways these last months in terms of the pandemic and trying to make it all work and keep my mind happy and doing everything that's necessary. And hopefully you'll find, you know, that these shifts in perspective that we're going to go through can be a good starting point to how to actually stay sane. So these are the five that I'm going to discuss. I'm not saying that they're the absolute list for possible shifts in perspective, but the first three are what are set out by His Holiness and the Archbishop. The other two I've added. So let's go through these one at a time. The very first one is keeping a wider perspective. So in the book, they talk about how with a wider perspective, meaning that we get outside of just the narrow view that we have, in that perspective, we can see our situation and all those involved in a larger context and from a more neutral position. And right now, we get so invested in our point of view and think that we're seeing the whole thing. You know, by seeing the many conditions and circumstances that have led to this event, we can recognize that our limited perspective is not the truth. You know, when I teach on this, I actually do a little course on the 8 pillars of joy. And when I teach on this first pillar, I bring in the little graphic that has to do with the story that many of you heard when you were younger. It's actually in one of the sutras of the Buddha in the Pali Canon. But it has to do with the 6 blind people that are all trying to describe what an elephant is like on the basis of holding on to only one part of the elephant. So the person who has the tail has a very different perception of the elephant than the person who has the tusk. And the person who's holding onto the ear or the side of the elephant or the feet or the trunk, they all have a different perspective. But do any of them know the whole elephant? That's the whole gist of that story, right? Is to recognize that they're not seeing the whole because they're only focused on their own narrow perspective. You know, there are a lot of times in our world where we are deciding what something is on the basis of solely our own perspective. Sometimes once more conditioning comes in to influence how we look at that. But we are not seeing it from a big picture perspective, from the larger overview that will take into consideration everything involved in that. And of course, Buddhism, one of the main tenets of Buddhism is this whole idea of universal causality, that there are causes and conditions that lead to things happening. And rarely is there just one thing that is the cause. In fact, I don't think there's ever that case where you only have one thing as the cause. You know, let's look at the issue of gun violence, for example, because still gun violence continues to be a problem in our society. You know, there is a tendency to see it from a particular point of view and say, well, if we only got rid of all of the automatic rifles, well, then we wouldn't have gun violence anymore, at least to the degree that we are seeing. And there may be some truth to that, but that's not the totality of the problem. We know that there are many more elements involved. And so if you ever identify just one thing and you say, well, if we get rid of that, that's going to solve the problem, it's extremely rare that that's the case because things arise from a variety of causes and conditions. So one of the shifts in perspective that is encouraged right from the beginning is to acknowledge that the way we are seeing it in terms of our limited view, because most of us are quite limited in what we can actually take in and perceive of a particular situation, our understanding is quite limited. That isn't the whole picture. That isn't the totality of it. Now, will we ever know the totality of it? That's kind of challenging. If you look at the gun violence situation, obviously it's a very complex thing in our world, but it's something that has many facets and features, and it's hard to get grasp of all of them. But I would propose that even just by entertaining the idea that I don't have the full view is already a healthy shift in our perspective. It leads us to be open to the idea of how others are looking at things. I will share one thing that came up for me after the last election in 2016. You know, there was, maybe a lot of people like myself who were quite surprised at how the election turned out and wanted to understand why. And so one of the books that I read that was really quite useful was this book called Strangers in Their Own Land, written by Arlie Russell Hochschild, I think is her name. Anyway, her story, she's like a UC Berkeley professor of sociology, and she, you know, is very liberal-leaning because she's in Berkeley and what have you. But she decided she would spend, this was prior to the 2016 election, she spent 5 years down where Hurricane Laura is headed in Lake Charles County, Louisiana. And she, like, tried to, you know, talk to people, get to in a perspective on what they thought about what was going on in the world around them, how they were looking at things. I'm not going to go into everything that she found through her investigation, but it was really eye-opening to me, and I'm as it was to her when she started talking to people, to hear that from their perspective, this is what led to the results in 2016 to a large degree. A lot of people whose voices and whose ideas weren't being listened to. They felt like they weren't getting their proper attention and share of the piece of the American pie, if you will, or the American dream, you know, that they felt somewhat disenfranchised towards. So again, there's like, I'm not going to again go into all the detail, but this is what we have to be willing to do, is to kind of look at it and say, there are many other perspectives and a bigger kind of overall perspective that we are blind to. Most of the times we're only seeing things from our limited narrow view. So this is one of these. Let's go on to the second one. And again, each one of these adds another dimension. And I'm not saying you have to adopt all of these, but I think it's worthwhile to take a look at each of them and see to what degree they might have an impact. Again, referring back to the meditation we did at the beginning of tonight. So the second one is holding a long-term perspective. This is such an important one. This means to not be solely focused on the short-term and immediate experience, but to see how in time things can change in many ways. this is the nature of our existence, right? Things are constantly changing. But we get so caught up in what we are immediately experiencing. And we think that that's it. That's what we have to deal with. And we almost make it into something that's going to be eternal, that is going to be unchanging. But things change. Things have changed since the 2016 election. Things have even changed since the pandemic started, when cases were first being reported to a larger degree in this country, you know, to where we are now. I mean, sometimes for the worse, sometimes for the better, but nonetheless, things have changed. As it says here, this allows us to see that even though our situation may seem challenging now, from the vantage point of a month or a year or a decade, these challenges will seem much more manageable. When I look at that idea of a decade, I was reminded of when I first started studying Tai Chi Chuan in San Francisco back in the 80s, late 80s. And my Tai Chi instructor very kindly said, in Tai Chi, we don't measure our progress in terms of days, weeks, years. We measure our progress in terms of decades. And sometimes it's useful to sort of recognize the longer term perspective, whether it be a decade or whether it be shorter end. But we can acknowledge that over time, things do change. I mean, as part of the Book of Joy, Thupten Jinpa, who is there as His Holiness's translator, he actually suggests what he calls a silver lining experiment. Look at a particular event in your life that was a very trying time for you, a real difficult challenge. And now look at it from the perspective of where you are now. And perhaps you can even find, in kind of scanning back through the years, that at some point perhaps it even became something beneficial for you. I know I can look at things in my life that I experienced early on that I found really, really difficult and trying. But nonetheless, because I was able to move through that and sort of see another side to it over time, it has become the silver lining to that cloud. It has become something really beneficial for me. And I would say that most of us have that experience in general, not to say that everything that happens that's negative to us has a silver lining, but we can still find something within it to work with. This is what we're going to look at in one of the later perspectives as well. But this idea of time being an element, having a long-term perspective. His Holiness the Dalai Lama often talks about the need for a long-term perspective. You know, in this bodhisattva path that most of us are aspiring towards, time is definitely involved. You know, it does take a great amount of time and effort to accomplish this path. So we can't get too caught up in the immediate experience. And this, of course, is what this did lead, in my mind, to a lot of the difficulty that people were having with COVID-19 when it all started, right? Because there was so much uncertainty to anything beyond that. The window of time we were working with was really quite close in. We were only looking at that day, perhaps. Okay, well, what's going to happen this day? And as each day things unfolded in a much more serious way and we started seeing the gravity of what we were involved in, it made the future look less and less bright and what we were dealing with much more dim. So this is, again, the reality that if we look back even now, which I'm finding certainly going back to what was happening in March, that it's already very different in terms of the space in my own mind to work with this. And still there's some level of concern and certainly wanting this to be addressed and wanting to go back to whatever it was perhaps, but maybe go to something else. I don't know, whatever follows from this. Time does play a great is a great element in all of this. Of course, they always say time heals all wounds, but nonetheless, this is from the vantage point of time actually giving a different perspective. So if we can hold that perspective in the moment, that some period of time from now, it could be very different. And we could even have a great advantage to this. Actually, I'm going to take it back off the screen because something else came to mind that I wanted to share. Another friend of mine on Facebook shared with me a little video that you might actually look at. It's very cute. It was done by, I think, a British man. And it's kind of him telling a bedtime story to his child. And it's called The Great Realization. And it's all about 2020 and what happened with the pandemic. But it's from the vantage point of, like, after it's all over and talking about this as being the epic of the Great Realization. This is a little bit of a hint of what we're going to look at the end when we start talking about active hope and moving in that direction. It's really up to us to frame what it is that we want to see this as. But over time, this may actually be one of the most beneficial things to happen to humanity on this planet. I'm not denying the incredible loss and the suffering that people have gone through. It's tragic that that has occurred. But humanity as a whole may benefit from what we have had to go through. climate change, of course, is threatening, but we don't see often the immediate effects of that, and we're seeing things much more gradual. This was sort of an in-your-face, stop dead in your tracks, change in your life. And, of course, we may be able to learn from this much easier than we're learning from the reality of climate change. So this is, again, back on the different perspectives. This is that long-term perspective that's so important. The third one is, of course, something that we learn about a lot in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, which is having a perspective beyond oneself to include others. This is maybe a bit of an extension of the first one. The wider perspective is seeing the big picture. This perspective is the idea that we have to get out of our individualistic point of view, where only our own needs are considered to be important, to a more collective one. A collective point of view in which the needs of others are taken into account. Self-centeredness, obviously, is our default perspective, but we also have the ability to take on the perspectives of others. So that book I was mentioning earlier, Strangers in Their Own Land, that kind of helped me to some degree to kind of see that, you know, while I can look at it and think I've got a very good idea of what the world should look like and what would be the best political party in charge and whatever the case might be, there are other people who feel equally valid and justified in their thinking about that. And I need to be able to listen to that and to hear that and to not think that my particular view from my individualistic place of knowing what's right and wrong and thinking this is the best and that's the worst, that is not necessarily absolute truth. There's that little bumper sticker that was going around quite a while ago that said, don't believe everything you think. Well, we know from Buddhism that this is so true. A lot of our thoughts are tainted. They are contaminated by a lot of the habitual patterns that we've had. And here the pattern is that tendency to be centered on ourselves. We often call this self-cherishing, but the idea is that it's a way of elevating our own point of view and our own needs to such a large degree that we often neglect the point of view of others. We neglect what their perspective is and what they see. So this is just once more, whether we are able to actually do that, to actually, you know, seek out others who are involved in different situations and get their point of view, but at least to entertain the idea that there are other people who have different views. You know, as challenging as it can be, sometimes I find it really useful to, you know, go to places where I'm hearing alternate views, particularly in the political environment. You know, because although, again, you may not completely agree with all of it, you have to hear that. You have to kind of acknowledge that other people have different perspectives. And the whole idea of right and wrong gets to be maybe not as important as at least having the awareness so that we don't hold so tight to what we have to where it becomes a source of even greater problems, greater difficulties in our world. So this is, again, how many times are we holding a point of view with regard to these trying times or difficulties that we experience personally that is solely focused on ourselves, not taking into consideration the other parties that are involved. So after that, again, His Holiness and the Archbishop go on to talk more about other facets, other features around perspective and the remaining seven pillars. I've included a couple of other things that I think are also important shifts in perspective, especially as Buddhists, for us to entertain. And this next one is seeing human nature as basically good. In Buddhism, we speak of Buddha nature, which teaches that the fundamental nature of human beings is good, and that it is only due to distorted states of mind that beings are blind to that reality. We can learn to trust in that fundamental goodness and relate to others from within that understanding. You know, I was quite comforted. There is a point later in the book where the Archbishop does talk about how he too sees beings as basically good. You know, when I grew up Catholic, I didn't get that impression. You know, I think I mentioned this last night, had that idea of sort of being tainted from the very beginning and needing some sort of savior outside myself in Jesus Christ to remove that taint or that stain of original sin. In Buddhism, once more, as I said last night, there's this idea that we are sort of fundamentally pure, that our nature, deepest nature of our being, which is the nature of our own minds, is free of all of that garbage. all the stuff that we are laying on top of everything is our own mental fabrication. And if we learn to undo that through a variety of techniques, you know, of course, that Buddhism teaches, we can know that deeper nature. We can abide in that deeper nature. And all beings have that. So even the most horrible, despicable person in this world and the most challenging situation we face, there's nothing that is separated from our Buddha nature in that, or their Buddha nature in that. That Buddha nature is always there. It's just temporarily obscured. It's clouds in the sky that are obscuring the sun. And as long as we, you know, get focused on the clouds and totally think that they're solid and never capable of moving, then the sun is always going to be obscured. But if we actually recognize that those things can be removed and that our whole work and the process that all beings are undergoing over time is to remove all of that and know their true nature that is fundamentally good, then we learn to trust in beings in a little bit different way. You know, there's a little story that I like to tell around kind of the my confidence that this sort of good nature exists within all of us. And I may have told this to this, you know, the folks at Kadampa Center before, but I had the good fortune of going to a Buddhist teachers conference in 2012 up at Garrison Institute in New York. And there were a number of teachers that were there. And one person that I saw, I didn't really get a chance to interact with him so much. At least at first, he was a little bit off-putting because he was, you know, tattooed and looked a bit rough streetwise, what have you. And I heard his story, and it was really quite amazing. His name is Vinny Ferraro. And Vinny grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, I believe. And he actually, the story goes that he got involved in drug dealing and he got into, you know, bad gang of people, and they would go out and beat people up with baseball bats. You know, this was what they did for fun. You know, incredibly cruel actions that I can't imagine myself engaging in. But nonetheless, this is what he did for fun with his friends. One night he's out there and he's got his baseball bat, and they come up to a homeless man. And he's getting ready to beat this homeless man, and the homeless man looks up and locks eyes with Vinny. And the homeless man says to him, "Please don't do this to me." And Vinny says, "What makes you think I'm not going to do this to you?" And this homeless man says to him, "Because you have the most compassionate eyes I've ever seen." And Vinny couldn't do anything from there. He couldn't beat this guy. I mean, there was something that broke through. It was like he had built an armor all around his Buddha nature, his good nature. But there's always a crack. There's always a little place where the light gets in. And the light of this man's, you know, words to him that came into his being and it changed, shift his own perspective of himself, you know, caused him to blossom from there. He became a Buddhist teacher and practitioner. Pretty amazing guy. Everyone has this. Again, even the most hardened heart still has that crack, still has that ability for something to get in. And of course, you know, everybody has that. We get blind to that though, right? We see people, they come into our sphere of experience and are doing and saying things that we believe to be their very nature. They're inherently evil. They're inherently awful. And trust me, it's a challenging one to get over, because when you see people doing this repeatedly, continually, you start to trust in it as their real state of being. But every one of those beings, even though they're manifesting that way, have this Buddha nature. Now, again, maybe we're not the ones, we're not the homeless man that can break through that and cause them to see that. But we have to at least hold the perspective that that's there. And then we can change our thoughts towards them. Maybe do what we can. Yeah, if there are people who are engaged in activities that we think are harmful to them and to the world, you know, both will be harmed by virtue of that. Do what we can to affect those, but don't do it with a mind of anger and what have you. Shift our perspective. See them also as a being that's worthy of compassion because they have Buddha nature, because they too can change. Just a matter of, you know, what they come into contact with when they meet their homeless man who kind of tells them they have the most compassionate eyes and causes their hard heart to break open. So the last one that I sort of added on here too is maintaining a positive attitude. By positive, I don't necessarily mean optimistic, though optimism might play a good role in it. you know, that it kind of all turns out in the end. What was that thing from the Marigold, Exotic Marigold Hotel, that, you know, it all works out in the end. If it hasn't worked out, then it isn't the end. But, you know, nonetheless, the idea behind a positive attitude here maybe embraces some other things. It says that can develop from remembering that our situation is workable and can quite possibly change for the better. But even if the situation does not improve, we can still hold the positive thought that this is an experience from which we can learn and grow. This is, again, where we're looking at everything that we meet through that lens, similar to what I was entertaining with the meditation tonight, right? That we could see it as something that we could actually learn from. You know, it was maybe a bit premature in me putting this posting on Facebook, but I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks after the pandemic thing sort of started and most people were in, you know, some form of lockdown or what have you. I found a little quote from Pema Chodron's book, When Things Fall Apart, that essentially says that nothing goes away until we've learned the lessons from it. And so I posed the question to people, well, since it's still around and probably will be around for a bit, what lessons are you learning from this? And what are the lessons you think you need to learn? But if we frame everything that we meet, again, our perspective is that what we have going on in our world, in our lives individually or collectively on this planet, is something that we can learn from, that it's a sort of a positive thing. Maybe we can change it too. I'm not denying, again, that we should affect change where it's possible. Master Shantideva, in his 10th verse of the 6th chapter of Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, says, if there's something that can be done about it, if it can be remedied, well, then there's no need to kind of get all dejected and worried and what have you, because you put your energy into changing it. On the other hand, if it's something that you can't change, well, then you're getting worried and dejected and bent out of shape. It doesn't really do much good because it doesn't affect any change. It's useless. And so why wallow in that? And of course, the implication is instead we change our minds. Instead, we learn to work with that reality. And there will be things that come up in our lives that are trying times that we can't change. I mean, I look at when we lose somebody very dear to us, we have to go through that process of grief. We can't make that person come back. There's no undoing of that. So we have to learn to work with our minds instead of that. You know, instead of trying to fix it on the outside, we have to fix it on the inside. So this, once more, this fifth one is the whole idea that there is a possibility to always see something good in regard to what we are experiencing. So the fourth one was kind of seeing good in the individuals that are involved. The fifth one is sort of seeing good in the situation that we're facing, something positive, something that can be affected, whether it be on the inside or on the outside, something that will move in a more positive direction. So these five, again, as I said earlier, they're by no means an exhaustive list of everything that could be a possible shift in perspective. But they're some way to begin to explore this idea of when I'm looking at this particular trying thing in my life, again, whatever that might be that's going on right now, take your choice. There are many of them out there. You know, you have an ability to choose how you're going to look at that. And are you going to look at it from your own narrow, limited view or from the wider perspective? Are you going to look at it from the short-term, immediate, what I'm getting right now and having to experience right now versus what might this look like way out in the future? Are you also going to tend to be only focused on what your needs are at that time or look at it from the point of view of others and what their needs might be and open up to that reality? And those others and yourself, are you going to continue to see everyone is fundamentally good? That if sort of when it all boils down to it, humans are good at their very core. And the situation itself can be something that is very valuable for us if we could choose to look at it in a positive vein, if we look at it as something that we will benefit from. Of course, those of you who've been around Tibetan Buddhism for a while know that a lot of what I've talked about then really falls neatly into the category of lojong or mind training. You know, how we are continually looking at what we are facing, whatever adversity, whatever difficulty, and trying to frame it in a much more positive light to see it. And that's what we're going to go into a little bit in terms of the meditations that are useful to actually make the most out of whatever it is that you're experiencing, kind of funnel it into developing your own understanding and deepening your own understanding of the Buddha's teachings. the text we're going to go through this weekend is sort of the progenitor of all of the Lojong teachings. It touches on some of these themes, but it's its own sort of text and has a lot of benefit in terms of looking at the actions and the thoughts that we bring into our daily lives. Let's go on to look at how these ideas of shifting, changing our minds, developing an ability to work with whatever it is that we meet, how this can be useful, and how we need some additional tools to do this. So this second idea of suggestions is to use our stabilizing meditation and mindfulness as a tool to help us. And why I put this on here, and it was kind of interesting, there's a student who I do talk with on a somewhat regular basis who has been going through a bit of a tough time because he really needs a lot more connection with others. And in this time where people are not connecting so much, it's really challenging for those folks in our world. And he was saying, you know, that from his experience, because when we meet, we always like to start with a minute of silence, of just a mindful awareness, and then a minute at the end to kind of be the bookmarks, or bookends, I'm sorry, of that time together. And there's really, right after we finished it today, he said, I have to remember that this is such an important part of my practice in terms of what he's going through. The difficulties that we have, this is something we always have with us. Even though we are confronted with the external reality of having to deal with, you know, masks and, you know, gloves and whatever else is all involved in the pandemic, and we're having to deal with, you know, all the conflicts that are going on in terms of the conventions and the political landscape, and all of this turbulence, it's all on the outside. There's a nice little calm place on the inside where we can regain so much of our composure, our strength, our ability to face things. Don't let that fall out of your practice during this time in particular. When you're dealing with trying times, sometimes that is your greatest salvation, is the ability to kind of go inside and just to sit quietly with yourself. Now, I mentioned stabilizing meditation. If you're new to Buddhism, in this tradition, we talk about two main forms of meditation, stabilizing meditation and analytical meditation. Stabilizing meditation is what we did at the beginning of today, simply using the breath or some other object as a place of focus. And when you initially start this practice, the mind is going to seem as turbulent as the outside world is. The inside world is going to seem like there's all sorts of things flying around and ideas and things to entice you and move you away from the breath. It's going to be very, very difficult to get the mind to focus. But be okay with that. It's not that there's more stuff going on in your mind. It's just that you're finally seeing what's all going on in our mind. Our minds actually have a great amount of excitement and disturbance and everything, you know, distraction happening. It's just that we don't pay that much attention to it. When you begin your meditation practice, you begin to see that. And if you stay with a meditation practice, and for those who are new, I really encourage you to start with very small increments of time. My first meditation experience was I made the mistake. I call it a mistake. I mean, I'm sure there was some benefit somewhere along the line from it, a silver lining to that cloud. But I had been doing some hospice work in San Francisco in the late 80s around the HIV epidemic. And there was a day for hospice workers to have a day of meditation for hospice workers. And I thought, wow, this sounds really good. I'd like to go to that. And it was really for more experienced meditators. We sat in 45-minute periods, which may not sound long for some of you who've been doing meditation, but you know at the beginning, 45 minutes is way too long. And there were about six sessions throughout the day. And we were sitting on a hard stone floor of a small chapel in Fairfax, California. And it was just excruciating. It really turned me off to meditation initially, and I've had to really work hard to sort of get past some of that. So my advice to those of you who are new to meditation, doing this type of stabilizing meditation where you're focusing on the breath, either at this point at the nose, or you can be focused on, you know, counting the breaths, or you can be focused on the sensation in the lower abdomen where it rises and falls. Lots of different ways to work with the breath. But, you know, make your periods very short. Just do that for a couple of minutes. And if you get a little timer, you can put a timing app on your phone or whatever, and you can just set it for a few minutes and then take a short break and then do another few minutes and then take a short break and do another few minutes. And when you feel like you're getting to a place where you've got pretty good concentration for those few minutes, then elongate it and then make it longer. But those periods, those sort of timeouts that you can have that allow you to go inside and to be more focused are really a breath of fresh air. And they do allow us to already let go of a lot of this sort of conceptual garbage, space junk that we have going on in our heads that causes us to react to our trying times in such difficult ways and challenging ways. You know? I'm sorry? Was that someone that needed to share something? Okay. So again, we do have the ability in our sort of stabilizing meditation to bring ourselves home, to bring ourselves into that place. And then I mentioned mindfulness in there too. Of course, mindfulness is a big buzzword. I think there's even Mindful Magazine now that's been published that, you know, is giving people daily advice or monthly advice, whatever, about maintaining a more mindful stance in one's life. Mindfulness is something we all have. You couldn't drive a car if you didn't have mindfulness. But what we're talking about here is when we apply that to our sort of non-forgetting, our being present with what is going on, especially in our meditation. But then we want to take that quality off the cushion too. You know, the whole point of doing our stabilizing meditation isn't just so that we get a little time out and then we go back to all the crazy turbulence. It's that we try to bring some of that back into our time off the cushion. And how we do that is through the force of mindfulness, through having a presence to be able to stay in touch with some of that, not forgetting the instruction, not forgetting to be aware, not forgetting to continue to do the work wherever we are. As I said, it's a 24/7 deal. Again, I'm not doing it 24/7. Don't get me wrong. I'm not advertising that that's what I'm doing. But know that this is kind of how we are trying to use Buddhist practice. So I put it on the list because I do feel like it's a really important component of our Buddhist practice. It sometimes gets neglected a bit in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. I do have people that come to my teachings from other traditions who've studied Vipassana, for example, for quite a few years and done these amazing 10-day Vipassana retreats. I've done one of them and pretty difficult. But you gain an ability to work with the mind in those types of settings that is really useful. And in Tibetan Buddhism, we emphasize meditation, but we maybe emphasize analytical meditation a bit more than stabilizing meditation. So I would just wanted to throw it on the list so you don't forget that that is a really important part of our practice. It first of all, again, gives you that sort of time out and ability to kind of remove yourself from that and find a place of calm. But then it moreover allows you to hopefully come from that place of calm with greater mindfulness and awareness so that you can then make the most out of your sort of situation off the cushion. So I want to take just a short break. I know with these two-hour teachings, especially on an evening when people have had a full day, it's a little challenging. So I'm just going to do 5 minutes. So I have like 1 minute after the hour. Let's give the benefit of the doubt and say at 7 minutes after the hour, we'll reconvene. That'll give you maybe part of another minute. So you get a chance to sort of get up, get some fresh air, some water, walk around, get the blood circulating, whatever's necessary, and then we'll reconvene. So again, just a short 5 minute break and I'll see you after that. Thank you. Thought I would ring the bell tonight in case people have wandered away from their device. So okay, so again, what I've talked about so far tonight then is this idea of shifting our perspective, which once more is so central to Buddhism. I often call this reframing. You know, the idea being that how we frame things causes us to experience them in a particular way. But, you know, whether we call it shifting our perspective, changing our view, the whole thing is getting down to the fact that each of us has the ability to choose how we are going to look at a particular situation and find it to be more beneficial by taking another perspective, and so on. So I won't go back over all of that material, but that was the first thing we talked about that is really quite important. The second one, which is maybe as important, is having some level of stabilizing practice to go to when we find things really difficult and trying. It's not the absolute answer because we can't hang out in meditation forever. And as good as our meditation might be, it's very hard to have a continuity of that awareness throughout our entire day, you know, as we go about our activities in the world. So it's not the final solution. That's why another form of meditation is taught in Tibetan Buddhism. Stabilizing is the first one where we use a single object to kind of focus on and try to allow the mind to rest in that place of natural focus, very alert and attentive. That form of meditation isn't about just kind of relaxing and chilling out. It's about keeping the mind at a very heightened level of awareness. Then the other one is done generally on the basis of some measure of stabilizing meditation, and that's what we call analytical meditation. And analytical meditation, as many teachers say, is just a fancy word, fancy two words, for thinking. It means reflecting, thinking, contemplating the teachings. So here's where we actually get into how do we take some of the main teachings that the Buddha set out and apply them at the time of dealing with trying times, dealing with difficulties. Because although we can shift our perspective, it's like sometimes it's useful to have something else to rely upon from Buddhist knowledge that will help us at that moment, that will give us an additional point of view to rely upon to actually make ourselves a bit saner, a bit more in charge when that's happening. So this is the third topic, utilizing analytical meditation. So there are five topics I've set out here. Obviously, there are many, many more. The Buddha taught a variety of things, but these are five I'm going to try to talk about, and I'll spend a little bit of time on each of these, some of them a little more than others. But they do have some roots in those shifts in perspective that we talked about earlier. Taking refuge is the very first one. You know, when we started tonight, Donna kindly led us, and one of the prayers was the refuge and bodhicitta prayer. Refuge, for those of you who are new to Buddhism, is kind of this finding a safe direction in the Buddha's teachings, especially, though also in the Buddha and the community that follow his teachings. We often call those the three jewels. But for most of us, I mean, the Buddha himself, of course, the historical Buddha lived some 2,500 years ago. There are Buddhas, enlightened beings that do exist, but it's maybe hard for us to know that we're, you know, accessing them on a direct basis. You know, some people in our world, we can maybe have some confidence that they're a Buddha. But maybe they're not, again, the real source of support for us right now. Neither are the Sangha, the spiritual community that have developed these realizations. They're useful on our path. But the main thing that we take our refuge in is the Dharma, is the teachings of the Buddha. They say this is the actual medicine, of course, you know, the Buddha being the great doctor who gives us the means of curing our situation. So the question that I'm, you know, kind of putting forward in terms of when we're dealing with trying times in regard to this type of meditation is to really examine, where is your refuge? When things are going bad on the outside, where is your refuge? What is it that you actually look to in terms of to support you through that? As I mentioned earlier, a lot of people, when the whole pandemic thing started, their refuge was, you know, Netflix and, you know, whatever, Apple TV or whatever you watch, you know, kind of getting totally lost in all of that. And maybe because they weren't working and they weren't really being able to do much else, maybe that made some sense. But it's obvious it's not the best refuge in the world. You can't like stay on Netflix forever and be continually happy. You know, we want to kind of make sure that we move in the direction of the more lasting happiness that the Dharma will lead us to. So what is your refuge at the time when you're dealing with trying times? Do you have the confidence that the Dharma is what you should be actually turning your mind towards? And the rest of the teachings we're going to look at, those other four points that were on the screen a short while ago, are all Dharma. But it often starts with our initial feelings of refuge. Who is it that we turn to for protection? What is it that we turn to for protection when we're dealing with difficult things? You know, and I think this is a good investigation to go into and to really see to what extent do we have that confidence in the Buddha's teachings. And of course, if we don't yet, if we say, no, thank you very much, ice cream and Netflix are still perfectly fine refuge for me, well, then maybe we have to do a little more investigation into the Buddha's teachings to try to increase our feeling of refuge. Once more, refuge is not a sort of destination that you arrive at. In Buddhism, we have what's called a refuge ceremony where people formally become Buddhists by, become Buddha, let's hope they become a Buddha. They become Buddhists by taking these sort of vows of refuge, a statement of refuge, by professing that. That's a moment in time. Refuge is a process, though. Refuge is something that's continually growing within us. It means the determination that we have to keep going back to the Buddha's teachings during our difficult times and through our good times as well. The teachings are there for both, but to rely upon those most sincerely. And this is why we continually, you know, practice it. Lama Yeshe, it said, actually used the term do refuge rather than take refuge, meaning it's kind of, I'm doing refuge. I'm doing my refuge when I'm, you know, looking at this difficult situation. I'm doing my refuge when I'm enjoying my morning breakfast. I'm doing refuge, whatever it is I'm doing. So this is, again, an important part of our path, and it becomes a bit foundational, because the extent to which the Buddha Dharma, especially the Dharma teachings that the Buddha gave, the extent to which those are your real refuge, means the extent to which you continually move your mind in the direction that the Buddha wants you to move your mind in, towards liberation, towards enlightenment, you know, being able to, you know, achieve these deeper goals. So the next thing that we have on the list has to do with kind of seeing the nature of cyclic existence. Cyclic existence, this is a translation often for this term, samsara. Samsara is essentially a state that we are in. It's not the world that we are experiencing around us, though it's, that is a part of it, obviously. We're mostly talking about the state that beings are in, the state of being under the control of various factors, our own karma, our delusions, and continually having experiences within this cycle of existence, going from life to life, and, you know, needing to see the unsatisfactoriness of this, you know. But when we have difficulties in our lives, it's evidence of the nature of cyclic existence not being so great. And one of the things that we tend to do is we always have this expectation that everything is supposed to be going our way and that we're supposed to have wonderful times all the time. I did some weekend teachings with the Denver group, and I think that's where I mentioned this. I hope it was. I didn't mention this. Yes, last night. Sometimes it gets hard to keep track of when I mention certain things. But Venerable Rabina, when she teaches, she says, you know, everybody has this question all the time of why do bad things happen? You know, and when we're dealing with this pandemic and with all of what's happening in our lives, we might keep asking that question. Why is this happening to me? Why do these bad things happen? But she says, nobody ever asks why do good things happen. We have an assumption that good things are supposed to be happening, maybe even an expectation that things are supposed to be happening in our favor. We kind of live our lives from that place of thinking it's all supposed to be hunky-dory. Everything is supposed to be wonderful from the time we get up to the time we go to bed. Maybe this sounds a little absurd to put it in these terms, but that is the underwriting thought that we have in regard to each day. We kind of think that that is how it's supposed to be. Is these things, you know, going our way and having good things and not having to deal with crises and conflicts and what have you? Well, examine that. That is really a bit fallacious, because we're in samsara. We're in cyclic existence. The nature of existence is that you're going to invariably have something change, and oftentimes change unfavorably. You know, even if we live a very rich, full life in terms of worldly terms, and you have all these amazing, wonderful things and lots of good friends and good experiences, where does it end? It ends in death. It ends in having to separate from all of that. So most of us don't have the good fortune of having no problems up until death. We have problems continually. Why most of you are tuning into this, you know, talk is because you are finding these times trying. You are finding difficulties all around you. This is evidence of the nature of samsara. And of course, it's not just the Buddha teaching this and saying, okay, well then get used to it, get over it. It's all, you're going to have problems, you're going to have difficulties. This is the nature of things. It's because that was where the Buddha started when he taught the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth, I mentioned these briefly last night, but the first noble truth is waking up to that reality. The Buddha saying, guess what, folks? You're in an unsatisfactory situation. I hate to say it, but you know, you're, as a patient, you're not well. If the Buddha's the good doctor, he's giving us that diagnosis. And then the second noble truth, he said, and why you're not well is because you're in this pattern where you're under the control of these factors. You're in a state where you're being controlled by your own karma, your actions, and the states of mind that are driving that. Your habitual ways of reacting to things that are not grounded in reality. So this is the first two truths give us that perfect view of the situation. What I'm saying in the second analytical meditation is to meditate on how what is happening in our world, the pandemic or political stuff or whatever, is evidence of the unsatisfactory nature of existence. It's showing us exactly one of the things that we need to be quite aware of. Now, it's also, we can say that also the fact that even the good times, the good things don't last, is evidence of the unsatisfactory nature of existence. The fact that you can't have every day sort of be smooth and delightful and running wonderfully, because things change, things come to an end. That's another level of unsatisfactoriness that the Buddha taught, that even the good things we have in our lives don't ultimately satisfy. So we can kind of see all of this as pointing out the truths that the Buddha taught. Of course, the Buddha went on in the last two truths to teach that there could be an end to this. There can be the cessation of our unsatisfactory existence. That would be like kind of pointing towards nirvana, towards the ability for us to attain a state of true peace where we're free of all those factors and therefore not having to go through all this nonsense. And how do we attain that? Through practicing the path, through actually engaging it. And of course, one of the mind states that's also necessary for that, which is the third point, that the second point, meditating on that kind of feeds into to some degree, is generating this idea of renunciation. I mentioned this last night as well as one of the three principal aspects of the path. Renunciation, when we hear the word in English, of course, we think that it has, implies that we're going to abandon all of our worldly goods and kind of go off and live in a cave and eat nettles or do something like that. And that's not how it looks for most people. You know, there was the great Tibetan saint Milarepa who practiced in that way. And there are many great other masters who practice in that way. But renunciation is a state of mind. It can manifest in terms of physical situations and corresponding things that we do. Because as we become more renounced towards the pleasures of existence and also see clearly the unsatisfactory things involved in all of existence, we develop a deeper and deeper commitment to move away from all of that. We see it as a trap, as a prison. And in that way, we become disenchanted with it. My teacher in Italy, Geshe-Jampi Gyatso, he mentioned that, you know, the main thing we have to develop renunciation of are the worldly pleasures. You know, we do get sucked into everything being delightful, wonderful. That's why, once again, seeing that things go awry, that we have these trying times, is evidence of the nature of psychic existence and then can be fed into our sincere wish to turn away from this. Because even if we get something pleasurable, it doesn't last. And when we get the unpleasurable, it's certainly not a lot of fun. So guess what, folks? It's all unsatisfactory. You know, I know this sounds a bit challenging, those of you who may not have heard these ideas before, but this is the degree that we want to get to, is where we lose our enchantment with samsara, with this type of existence that we're currently experiencing. These trying times can very much be funneled into this. I have to admit that from my own experience, I mean, I like to, you know, sort of live up to bodhisattva ideals and sort of practice all these amazing things we're going to talk about next of compassion for others and bodhicitta and all this when we're dealing with challenges. But I have found that working with these in terms of renunciation, funneling what's going on with the pandemic into renunciation, has really hit home with me in a very different way than the teachings on compassion so far. Maybe I needed to work on my renunciation a bit more to get greater compassion for others. But, you know, I've had the good fortune of not being personally impacted by this yet. Many people that are listening to this know people who have developed coronavirus and perhaps even died from that. You know, my own closeness, proximity to the disease is not so great. So it's forcing me to look things maybe a little bit more at myself. Not that I'm not moved by the situation of others, but that's just, you know, happens to be what I'm doing. So this third one is a very important one. When you're dealing with trying times and difficulties, why get all caught up in the patterns of anger and frustration with that? Come to recognize that that is part and parcel of the nature of things. It's just, as I said earlier, more evidence that we have to move away from that towards samsara. Towards nirvana. Move away from samsara towards nirvana. If I'm talking too much, I'm starting to mix up my words. Hopefully not getting dyslexic. So let's go on then to the next one, training in compassion, and then that will feed into the fifth one, cherishing others and cultivating bodhicitta. Training in compassion, of course, we could say that the reason why the Buddha taught everything that he did is because of compassion. You know, and why we practice it ideally is because of compassion at one level or another. You know, everything starts, and we could say the mind of renunciation is a form of self-compassion. It starts with seeing our own suffering very clearly and funneling all that stuff that we experience in these difficult times into our own wish to be liberated from suffering, from difficulty, from dissatisfaction. But eventually that has to be mirrored in what we see in other people. We come to recognize that we're not alone in our suffering, and that others are actually suffering to a large degree, many of them much more than ourselves. And again, from what I was talking about earlier, I can certainly see that. And that's, you know, a recognition that is very helpful to kind of open my eyes up to the ways in which others are suffering way beyond what I'm suffering. Not to diminish my own suffering, but to help me to open my heart even greater. You know, our own sufferings can become incredible touchstones to connect with the suffering of others. And this is why they say actually this human life, I'm not going to get too much into Buddhist cosmology, but they say there are other forms of existence that are much freer of problems and difficulties, and you have a lot more happiness than what they call the God realms and the demigod realms. The problem with those realms, though, is that you don't have this measure of suffering in your life that triggers you to connect with others and to really want to be free of all of that, yourself even. So this human existence is said to actually be a very, very powerful one because it has a nice measure for most of us of what we call suffering and what we call happiness. We can kind of see the potential to experience deeper and deeper happiness, but we can also see how suffering reminds us of our own situation and also helps is to connect to others. So the ability to make great strides on the path in some of these higher realms is not as great as it is here in this human realm. If we use our suffering to connect to others when we are experiencing some difficulty ourselves, we can extend that out and think about others who are engaged in something similar or maybe even the same thing, but at least start opening up to that idea that we're not alone in our suffering. In fact, everyone else on this world and wherever beings exist is pretty much in the same predicament when it comes down to the deepest level of what we talk about as samsara, the fact that we're all under the control of these factors, all continuing to go from life to life. As long as those beings are in samsara and, you know, have not been liberated from the causes of that, they will continue to experience that, and therefore we can have great compassion for them. Now, that compassion begins to manifest in terms of these last two. Let me put that up on the screen again. It had to do with cherishing others and developing bodhicitta, cultivating this mind that is the most powerful, positive mind that we can have. When we are dealing with difficult times, those who are strong-minded, those who are very courageous, can actually use what they are experiencing as a means of letting go of so much of that self-centeredness that we talked about earlier. Remember, we examined that shift in perspective away from self-centeredness towards being other-focused, other-centered. Well, this is a key part of the Mahayana path, again, is to open up to the reality that we are going to be at our best, and we actually are going to have the most positive impact on both ourselves and others when we do cherish others, when we hold them very dear. This is a theme we'll see also this weekend when we look at this Bodhisattva's jewel garland. But this is, again, very important, because if we don't ever address that mind that is trapping us in our own patterns of essentially self-destruction, and we learn to, you know, move away from that to embracing the welfare of others, our needs are never going to get met, and the needs of others will never get met. His Holiness the Dalai Lama talks about how that move to cherishing others is actually the way to be wisely selfish. The way to actually take care of ourselves is to take care of others. Now, what does that look like in terms of these trying times that we're dealing with? You know, I think it'll look very different for each of us individually. There may be some of us who feel quite qualified to be able to go and provide some measure of, you know, in-person support to people who are suffering. That's an incredible way to cherish others. But for many of us, it's simply just holding the thought and the wish that others not suffer deeper than just our compassion, where we really want to put them first. We really want to do whatever it takes to help them, even if it's just simply initially with our minds, with our thoughts, with opening our mind with love and compassion for them. But nonetheless, you know, that cherishing others eventually takes root in the mind that we call bodhicitta. Bodhicitta, of course, is this most altruistic aspiration we can have, to dedicate ourselves fully to the welfare of others. That's the main aim of bodhicitta. We have a secondary aim because we recognize that to be fully dedicated to the welfare of others and help them continually, we're not qualified to do that. You know, I haven't worked on myself to the greatest degree to be able to do that. Therefore, I have to become a Buddha to do that. So once more, when we're looking at these difficulties that we're experiencing, they can be reminders of any of these things we've looked at. we can bring them into our sort of analytical meditation and say, you know, as I'm experiencing the pandemic, where is my true refuge? Does this help me to see the true nature of psychic existence? Does it help me to generate renunciation that wants to be free from this? Does it help me to cultivate compassion for others? Does it help me to learn to cherish them and to actually cultivate the mind of bodhicitta that is the ultimate example of cherishing others? You know, everything can be grist for the mill in that way. And, you know, I find myself, again, if I didn't have Buddhist teachings during all of this, I think it would be very challenging. I mean, I look at the world at large and I really wonder sometimes how people are dealing with all of this. And I guess there are quite a few people who aren't dealing with it so well, who are certainly finding that what we are dealing with, especially with the pandemic, is more than they can handle. And, you know, they say that a lot of the mental health issues that are coming to the forefront right now, certainly for adults, but even for children. I mean, children, of course, are facing something that they had no idea that they would be facing at all. Not even, they haven't lived long enough to sort of have some perspective on all of this. So we obviously have, you know, a lot of people who are suffering and who are, don't have necessarily the tools to work with. In my experience, the Buddhist tools that I just went through, and there are many others within the teachings that we can use, but those are the main ones that I think can be really useful in these difficult times. So again, that was everything I think I needed to say on that. I've got about a half hour left, and I think I've got plenty of time to go through this. This one I'm going to share a bit more of others' words, because I feel like I'd be misstating them potentially if I said them myself. But we get now into this very last topic, which in a sense could be an extension of all three of these to some degree. As I mentioned, in Buddhism, we don't use the word hope so much. I mean, and there is even, I've even seen some Buddhist teachings that say hope is sort of a, one of the demons, one of the obstacles. And that's when it you simply sit around and hope for things to get better, but don't do anything to make things get better. That's why, once more, there's this idea we're going to be looking at, which is called active hope, which means the hope that we need that guides us by our intentions, and then we act from that place. So in their book, which is called Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy, and it's primarily a book directed at the climate crisis, Joanna Macy, or something, I can't remember her exact title that she's given herself. I think she's over 90 years old now, and she's quite amazing. I've never met her personally, but I love this book. I think it's quite a few years old now. I think it was maybe came out in 2012 or 13, maybe something like that, 15. I don't remember the exact year. It's been out some time. And she partnered with this man, Chris Johnston, who kind of helped write this book that is all about their view of hope. It's got the stuff at the top that's sort of blocking things, but it says here, whatever situation we face, we can choose our response. When facing overwhelming challenges, we might feel that our actions don't count for much. Yet the kind of responses we make and the degree to which we believe they count are shaped by the way we think and feel about hope. So that very first part may have made you think a little bit about Viktor Frankl, right? Whatever situation we face, we can choose our response. We can choose how to look at it. We can choose what we do on the basis of it. It even harkens back to what Rinpoche said at the very beginning, right? That it's, oh, so important, every moment, what we choose. And again, just so you know, Joanna Macy herself, I don't know if she professes to be Tibetan Buddhist, but she has a lot of Tibetan Buddhist leanings, and she even brings into that book the story of the Shambhala warrior, you know, the Bodhisattva warrior who returns at these very difficult times to, you know, face up to the challenges and courageously work to the betterment of all. But anyway, this is the truth is that, you know, the kind of responses we make and the degree to which we believe they count, you know, that they're infused with some sense of meaning and that they matter, that's shaped by how we think and feel about hope. So we're kind of reclaiming this word hope because, once more, I do feel like it's gotten kind of a bit of a negative spin, but nonetheless, it's a very important one. So the word hope has two meanings. You know, the first involves hopefulness, where our preferred outcome seems reasonably likely to happen. If we require this kind of hope before we commit ourselves to an action, our response gets blocked in areas where we don't rate our chances too high. you know, if we need this kind of hope that ensures that if we put our attention there, it will all change for the better. That may be not so likely a lot of the times, right? Because sometimes things can't change for the better, at least they can't in the time being. So this is sometimes a problem for us, is if we have this sense of hopefulness that isn't really aware of the reality of what the situation is, because we are thinking we're investing in something that we want to happen, and it has to have some likelihood of happening before we'll even kind of go in that direction. The second meaning is about desire, and she uses desire here not in the sense of like the delusion of desire, but in the sense of an aspiration. It is this kind of hope that starts our journey, knowing what we hope for and what we'd like or love to take place. It is what we do with this hope that really makes the difference. So here again, we're not so invested in the idea of, is it likely that we are... I'm having a problem with the Zoom meeting. Are all of you there? Hello?
We're here. We are here. We're just not, the video seems to have frozen. The audio is still going.
Oh, okay.
So at least for me, I can still hear everything you're saying. I just don't have the visual.
Oh, okay. I'm not sure why this is happening. I've never had this happen on Zoom before. Okay, so I will continue with what I'm doing, and then we'll see if at some point it comes back.
We haven't been able to see anything for a little while.
Oh, really? For a little while. Okay. So again, I'll share what's on the slides in terms of the content of it, and I'll talk a little bit about it. Again, these first two slides had to do with sort of two different ways of approaching the idea of hope. The first being, again, a sense of hopefulness where the outcome seems like it's going to happen. And that's, you know, something that may be so, but if we require that, then we're not going to be so likely to always have that level of hope. The second meaning of hope is about our sort of internal aspirations, knowing what we hope for and what we'd like to happen, to take place. It doesn't mean we have the confidence it absolutely will. It just means we have the good intentions that guide that hope, that really help us to move in that direction. And then there's also, of course, what we might call a more passive hope, which I guess is where hope kind of gets a bad name, is because it seems to be about waiting for some sort of external agencies to bring about what we desire. You know, as much as I was admiring Obama's campaign using the word hope, which seemed at the time to be a very important word to resurrect then as well, nonetheless, you know, if people had the idea that a new president, as we might have, you know, for some of us for this coming election, is going to bring about everything we desire, that we can just sit back and that person's going to take care of it all, I don't think that's the proper hope to have. Active hope is what we're talking about here, becoming active participants in bringing about what we hope for, what we want to happen. Active hope, they say in the book, is a practice. It's like Tai Chi or gardening. It's something we do rather than have. It is a process we can apply to any situation, and it involves three steps. You know what I'm thinking is, I'm wondering if it might be good for me to exit and come back in. Does that sound possible? Are you there, Donna?
Yeah, let's give it a try.
Okay, so let me exit out, and I will try coming right back in.
Okay.
We can always hope that'll work.
Good one.
Okay. Now you can see me.
Well, it my little list of participants didn't show you actually leaving the meeting.
Really?
Did
it change in terms of what you can view?
No, it's still showing. You know what I'm going to do is, okay, that changed. Okay, let's try now.
Okay. And can you put me back on as host to see if I can share the screen? Okay. Sorry about that, everyone. I don't know what happened. We did have a storm that came through while I was teaching earlier, and I don't know if that had some impact. It wasn't a huge storm by any means. We need a lot of rain here. It would be nice to get some. But so are you seeing the slides now?
Yes.
Okay, good. So we're sort of back where we were then. Good.
And
so
I was to say that we all stayed sane in these trying moments.
Good, you're doing really well. I congratulate you. Yeah, I could tell that there was something weird because my screen did seem to freeze up, but then when you came in, it was good that you clarified what was happening. So again, when I was talking about active hope, again, this idea that we're not going to be passive and sort of wait for something to happen. We're also going to not need the confidence that things will necessarily end with the result that we seek. We're just going to do it because we have the good intention of moving forward with it. And here, as they say, it's a process that we can apply to any situation, especially challenging situations, trying times. And it involves three steps. First, we take a clear view of reality. I think, again, this is the one thing that is difficult sometimes, but we have to be willing to look at everything involved. That's a bit of like that first perspective, the wide perspective, being able to hold as much awareness of everything involved and have a clear view of it to see what we are really involved in. Second, we identify what we hope for in terms of the direction we'd like things to move in or the values we'd like to see expressed. This is a kind of that inner searching that we each need to do in terms of getting in touch with our own deepest intentions and motivations. And of course, for Buddhists on the Mahayana path, it generally comes down to bodhicitta, to what will enhance and help us to move in the direction of helping beings to the greatest degree. And again, that may manifest in more specific ways in terms of the individual situation, but nonetheless, it's always flavored with that type of intention. Then third, we take steps to move ourselves or our situation in that direction. You know, that it doesn't involve just hanging out in that intention. You know, bodhisattvas develop this, you know, quite amazing intention of bodhicitta, but they don't just sit there kind of on their own, you know, in their own little world. They get very active in the world, you know, because they need to be able to be responsive to, you know, others and to doing what is necessary for, you know, the benefit of others. So let's go back to the screen again and go into a little bit more of what they say about this, these three steps again of seeing clearly what the whole situation is, setting one's good intention and what direction we'd like to move in with that sort of hope element. Hope, again, not being sort of blind and passive, but rather very active, and then act from there. So since active hope doesn't require our optimism, we can apply it even in areas where we feel hopeless. The guiding impetus is intention. We choose what we aim to bring about, act for, or express. I think this is a very important one because we are living in some times where some things might feel a bit hopeless. You know, of course, as I mentioned, this book was written primarily around climate change. And of course, climate change continues to be a problem. I think we're at a point where most people do have some conviction this is a reality. I think we even saw that when the pandemic started and all the people who would normally be out on the road weren't driving their cars, and a lot of the activity in factories and things that was shut down, that they saw a decrease in so many of the measures that are, you know, had been shown in the past through science to be man-made. We have evidence that they are man-made. They are caused through human actions, even just in these last few months and into, you know, what we have noticed from less activity on the planet. But nonetheless, it does feel pretty hopeless because how do we stop this huge turning world and everybody on it and all the stuff that's going on and rectify what we have done over these last, you know, decades, centuries? You know, it gets to be really challenging. So active hope doesn't require that. Active hope, it can be a hopeless situation, in quotes, hopeless. We still can have active hope. We still can work from our intention. We still can work from our place of our deepest wish for how we would like it to be, what we would like to invest ourselves in. So again, I think this is an important dimension to active hope. The guiding impetus, once more, is intention. We choose what we aim to bring about. This is a big word tonight, right? Choosing how we are going to look at things, choosing how we are going to act, you know, how what we want to express. Whoops, sorry, hit two slides there. Rather than weighing our chances, and proceeding only when we feel hopeful. We focus on our intention and let it be our guide. Future generations will look back at the time we are living in now, the kind of future they look from, and the story they tell about our period will be shaped by choices we make in our lifetimes. Now, again, even though, as I mentioned, this book is framed entirely around climate change, I don't want you to think only in those terms as I'm reading these words from these two authors, because I think we are talking about advice that can be applicable to anything. You know, I've heard that statement a lot from a lot of people around the pandemic, especially parents. You know, I don't have children, so I don't have that dimension to my life. But a lot of people on television who have been talking about their own concerns around the pandemic are speaking to this of how they need to give voice to the things that are taking into consideration how future generations will be looking at our behavior now, how they will be looking at what we did and what we didn't do, and how we did react to something or in a positive way versus, you know, go back to our habitual patterns and just, you know, fall complacent or whatever the case might be. So this is where, again, I think there's a lot of value to this in whatever situation we talk about, even with racial justice issues. You know, this is an important aspect of shaping our future to some degree. And at least if we say, yes, we are committed and we were committed to affecting the change we want to see in the world, we had that type of hope. Well, regardless of how it all turns out, we can certainly, you know, give our future generations something that they can, you know, embrace, the stories that we tell them that are influenced by our own choices. The most telling choice of all may well be the story we live from and see ourselves participating in. This is a bit going back, hearkening back to some degree to how we, you know, have a certain perspective, how we view things, but there's going to be a slightly different way that they talk about it that I think is quite useful. You know, this sets the context of our lives in a way that influences all other decisions. What is the story that we are living from? The story that we are participating in? You know, there's different stories. I mentioned that wonderful story that the man is telling his child after the pandemic and the post-pandemic years about the story that unraveled from all of that, that, you know, gave us this amazing, great realization after having gone through this pandemic together as a human race. I mean, that's a story that we can begin now. It's a story we can start living now. But they have different stories that they present that, of course, we could say are to some degree the tendencies that people have when they deal with any sort of trying time. So in Active Hope, they discuss three stories of our time in relation to climate change that are essentially three choices. The first one is business as usual. Of course, this is what we have seen even in the pandemic to a large degree, right? You know, that there are so many forces in the world, political forces, business forces, what have you, that want us to just go back to business as usual. You know, let's just keep everything going. Let's just keep it all humming along. And of course, in climate change, this is the tendency to sort of put our blinders on and think, oh, nothing's going on. We're just going to keep doing what we're doing, consuming what we consume and all the various things and not pay any attention to that. That's one story. That's a choice. Some people buy into that choice and some people live from that choice, but that's their choice and how they deal with the trying times. It's a bit, you know, of a somewhat, I don't want to use the word deluded, but certainly, you know, not fully embracing everything. It certainly is more taking a different type of refuge, a refuge in ignorance to some degree. The second story is the story that's called the Great Unraveling. The Great Unraveling is, of course, when we look at the world that we're living in and we almost think, you know, Armageddon's right around the corner, you know, this is all going to fall apart, you know, let's just, you know, fiddle while Rome burns kind of thing, you know, not embracing kind of the destruction of whatever it is that's going on, you know. So again, in the pandemic, I see this to some degree too, people who just fall into some sort of despair and think that this is just something that they can't even deal with because it's just too much, it's overwhelming, and they're going to just see it as the unraveling of our world to some degree. You know, maybe that's a little extreme, but nonetheless, there's a flavor in terms of how people are looking at it. The last one is the story that she's proposing as a better story to buy into. And she calls it the Great Turning. The Great Turning being similar to this idea that I mentioned about the Great Realization, you know, that what we can see is that this is a particular time when things can shift in a much more positive way. And wouldn't it be wonderful to buy into that story rather than the story that the other two are propounding, that it's just all going down the tubes, or that we're just going to keep plowing ahead and neglect it, and it'll maybe go away, maybe it'll be a miracle, it'll all disappear, I don't know. But, you know, those two stories have their own audience. But the story of the great turning is one for those of us who want to take this courageous stance, who want to invest in active hope, who want to move forward with a view, a vision, a perspective of what could be on the other side of all of this. You know, and again, it may not turn out that way. We may not have complete success in doing this, but we do it because it's the right thing to do, because we feel the strong intention to do it. It's kind of, again, you know, when we think about the Bodhisattva path and everything that I've talked about already tonight, and that many of you know from your own study of that, you know that it's a pretty idealistic way of looking at things to some degree. I'm going to develop myself completely and develop every being in the world to that degree. Well, you know, there may be a day when that happens. We like to hold that view of, you know, all beings enlightened. We even call that the Great Enlightenment. This word great gets used a lot in this context. The Great Enlightenment, when all beings are in that state. And we've contributed to that because we've gotten enlightened ourselves. You know, but whether or not that can actually happen, and there was even a debate in one of the texts that we studied in the master's program in Italy about whether this is possible. Is this possible for there to be all beings removed in abiding in that state of enlightenment? But whether or not it's impossible, it's still the right thing to do. We still feel that strong motivation to engage in that view, that active hope. So I like this concept of active hope because I think it's very much the Bodhisattva path. It's the acknowledgement that we have a choice of how we are going to respond to the suffering of the world. Are we going to keep plowing ahead and think, doesn't matter? Are we going to get totally depressed by it and think, oh my God, it's just too overwhelming, I can't handle it? Or are we going to roll up our sleeves with a vision, a view of where we want to go and do the work that's necessary to get us there? Whether or not, again, it actually happens to the degree that we think it will, it's a useful venture. It's something that we can actually feel good about having invested in. So let me read a few more things that they share from the book that I think are really quite nice. In choosing our story, we not only cast our vote of influence over the kind of world future generations inherit, but we also affect our own lives in the here and now. I mean, isn't this so true? You know, we're not just talking about what, who inherits what we do in the future and the beings that will come after us and the effects of our own actions and our own intentions now, but we are benefited by that. We live much more joyfully, more fully by actually being dedicated in this way. When we find a good story and fully give ourselves to it, that story can act through us, breathing new life into everything we do. When we move in a direction that touches our heart, we add to the momentum of deeper purpose that makes us feel more alive. A great story and a satisfying life share a vital element, a compelling plot that moves toward meaningful goals, where what is at stake is far larger than our personal gains and losses. Again, the big picture. The great turning is such a story. So I like, again, in this idea of the great turning, she goes into much more detail in that in the book, which I won't go into tonight. But one of the main elements in it is this whole concept that was part of that video of the great realization. It was the idea that there could be an actual shift in consciousness. You know, and we're not just talking about the individual shifts in consciousness that Buddhism is talking about, but we're talking about the shift in consciousness of this planet and all the beings on it. The idea that by our own strong intentions and active hope and being engaged in the world during these trying times, we can influence and shape where the general consciousness is in the world, to move things from the tending to be, again, much more self-centered, much more focused on this, my country first, you know, all the various things that are becoming obstacles in our world. And we can begin to embrace the totality of human experience, animal experience, all the experience of being in this world. You know, it's a very profound vision. And I think it's totally possible. Of course, you know, sometimes when you say these things, they sound like I wasn't a hippie in the 60s. I was still growing up in the 60s. But nonetheless, you know, look at all the ideals that people held at that time that many have said, you know, sort of fallen to the wayside. Well, they're always still there. We just need to keep elevating them to a greater sense of importance. that we need to begin to acknowledge, and maybe this is the right time, maybe through the pandemic, maybe through climate change, maybe through whatever it is that humanity has yet to face in this world, we're going to finally learn that we have to stop doing things in a much more self-centered way and embrace the welfare of all, embrace what we are really meant to do while we are here in this time on this planet. You know, to move towards that goal of achieving our own greatest potential and helping others to do the same in Buddhist terms. So again, this is something that I hope has been of some benefit to sort of share a little bit of this. I may have one or two slides, and so let me just go check and make sure that I haven't sort of shortchanged the slides. I'm going to let that go. Those are okay. Let me start with end with these final thoughts from Joan Halifax Roshi. She's the, again, director of Upaya Center, was. I think she stepped down from that role, but she's still quite involved in the center. This was a quote from a Lion's Roar newsletter that came out after the election in 2016, but it's equally applicable during these trying times. So please stop and look deeply, and let's work together and not building a contentious future, but a generative one. And let's not pretend we know, but be open and learn. Let's bear witness to what is happening in our country, in our world, and take wise, compassionate, and courageous responsibility. So I thank her for those words. I've only met her once, I think, once or twice, and she's a very dear soul, and I really admire her. But I think this is what we have to do, is we have to recognize that all the problematic ways of reacting to what's going on in our world are only going to create more conflict. We all have to have a change to some degree, a shift in consciousness at some level that begins to see that there are better ways to go about living our lives in this world, you know, for all of us, everyone involved. It's a lot of work. We got a lot of work ahead of us, but active hope will get us through, hopefully. So any comments or questions from anybody in terms of anything I've talked about tonight? Yes, Andre. Are you unmuted or do I need
you? Yeah, I just unmuted. You can hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Great. Yeah. I know when you were talking about choice, you were talking about choosing the story that that would be best, like a more hopeful one and so forth. Well, when you start talking about choice, and I'm thinking about the pandemic and stuff, one of the things I realized that sometimes the choices that people make impact me, and I have a difficult time with that, and I'm trying to have a more more open mind about it, and just realize that everybody has their own point of view about things. But when someone decides that, you know what, I'm just not going to wear a mask, or I'm not going to social distance, you know, that affects me if I go into the store, right? Yeah. If someone decides once we get a vaccine, mm-hmm. I'm not going to take the vaccine. And we know that's going to happen. We've already had people say, I'm not going to take the vaccine. And so sure. They don't believe in vaccines. That affects me. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if you can speak, how can I want to say to them, you know what? No, your choice is no good for me. And what do I do about that? You know?
Well, that's a really tough one, Andre. Yeah.
Yeah.
I empathize with you because I think, again, this is the world that we live in, right, is that we like to uphold individual freedom, and we do see it as a value in this country that I think is also a universal value, where we would like mm-hmm. beings everywhere, humans everywhere, to have some ability to be free in the choices that they can make to a degree. Obviously, we do have laws and rules that keep people from having ultimate freedom where they can just do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so it gets to be a little bit challenging in the world that we live in, because we cannot, become like a policeman for the entire world. And there are mm-hmm. certainly some people who maybe have that as an occupation. But for us as individuals in the world, I think if we can find a skillful way of helping others to see that they could be acting in a different way, that may be useful. But, you know, I've seen too many of these situations where people get into these entanglements with people who aren't abiding by tests, and it can go both ways. So people right. who think that all the people wearing masks are ridiculous, and the people, you know, and so you get too much energy, too much emotional stuff attached to it.
Yeah. And I want to stay away from that if I can.
Yeah, and I mean, again, this is where we are limited sometimes in what we can do. Mm-hmm. This is just the reality of the world that we live in. I mean, I would say the Dalai Lama probably couldn't get somebody to wear a mask if, you know, the Dalai Lama was at the store wearing his and, you know, other people were there and they weren't. I think he'd have a hard time convincing people that they needed to do that. He'd maybe be able to make them laugh a little bit because of his air, his lightness and what have you. But you know, at least we have to work with our own minds all the time. This is, of course, the advice that the Buddha gave us perennially. It's just always comes back to our own minds. So this is one of those things we have to face and go, I may not be able to fix all the things in the outside world, even some of the things that directly impact me or might indirectly impact me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a reality of the world that we live in. I'm not saying, again, if there is a skillful way where we can do that, free of any delusions, free of any anger, free of any judgment, free of anything, you can really do it with genuine compassion for the other person and everyone involved.
Yeah.
Then maybe try it. But, you know, keep in mind that a lot of people, that they may not be receptive to that. That's coming from our side, but where they are at may be very, very different.
Yeah.
And I certainly wouldn't just encourage anybody to go and, you know, try this with anybody who's in that situation, and you know, because you may end up having a pretty negative experience from all of that.
Right.
But, you know, and I think it's more important for us to continue to be here and do the work than to put our lives at risk for the sake of.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, there are some things that maybe are worth putting our lives at risk. When we look at, again, what's going on in our country around racial injustice and what have you.
Absolutely.
People, you know, that are putting their lives on the line sometimes because they do see the importance of this in our world. I mean, that's elevated to maybe an even greater level of importance than the mask situation. But nonetheless, I think each of us has to look at this from our own point of view to kind of get to a final answer on this. Look at it from your own point of view in terms of, once more, what is the perspective that is causing you to see it in that way? Is there a way you can shift perspective? Is there a way that you can possibly do something from that perspective? If there isn't, well, then maybe resign yourself to that reality that you just have to let people do what they need to do, regardless of it not being what you would ideally like them to do, and continue doing what you're doing, happily knowing that it's what you want to do to protect yourself and others in the world.
Right.
You know, I don't feel like it's, you know, although it's dangerous, and certainly there are people who are becoming the cause of spreading this virus by virtue of not taking it as seriously as they should. But I don't know. I mean, what else to do? We can try to influence governors of states, other politicians to support, you know, greater laws and rules on this, just like we have rules to keep people from doing other things.
Yeah.
You know, we should be able to affect some change that way. And vote for people who you feel support those causes for you, you know, that really kind of support that, because we don't have the power to make everybody in our grocery store wear a mask.
Right.
It's just not going to happen.
I certainly understand people's fears about like vaccines and so forth. I mean, I take a lot of medication for my disability and stuff, and there's always these adverse reactions that I get from this.
Sure.
You know, so I understand that. So I try to see it from their perspective. But my thing is that, my gosh, if you don't do anything, you know, to try to prevent it, you're going to get it. You know,
how's it ever going to go away?
How's it ever going to go away? You know, it's like, you know, so it's really hard to have that wider perspective on a lot of these matters and so forth. Yeah. It's much easier for me to have a wider perspective when I see people's views about racial matters and so forth, because I grew up in this country. I grew up in the segregated South. I understand, to some degree, racist views and so forth. I think that we all have these tendencies and have some views, maybe not racist, but we certainly have our likes and dislikes, and so forth, you know? So I can understand that to some degree, and, much better than I can understand why you would go, you know, just go to this place to a pool party, knowing that we're in the midst of this, you know, this pandemic, and knowing that how it spreads and stuff like that. you know, that makes no sense to me. I don't understand that one.
Well, yeah, I hear what you're saying, Andre, and I can kind of get the point in terms of racism versus, you know, being anti-vaccine or whatever. It's some of these things that seem to be so much grounded in science that you would think people would be able to look at sort of facts and have some conviction on the basis of that versus racism, which is more, I don't know if I've okay in using the word attitudes, but it has to do with, again, but if we look at either of those things, we can see that once more, back to the Buddhist idea of causality, there's causes and conditions behind either of those.
Yeah.
You know, the causes and conditions might be very different for someone who's an anti-vaxxer, but they still have causes and conditions that have led them to that. And I would say the case in, for both of them, what is the antidote to both of them over time? It's knowledge. It's wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
It's knowing things. It's having understanding that goes beyond what one has learned that may or may not be in line with reality. And in the case of the things we're discussing, we could say that they aren't in line with reality, but they are nonetheless conditioned by that type of thinking to think that way, to act that way. So I'd say another thing that we just have to be continually propounders of the truth. You know, as much as possible in whatever way that we can, you know, and help support organizations that do support the truth and that do help the truth to get out there, you know. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what else to say in terms of our worldly sort of things. Obviously, in Buddhist terms, it always still comes back to recognizing the things I mentioned tonight, that this is evidence of the unsatisfactory nature of existence, that this is also evidence of what's behind all of it, and that we need to do what we can to help beings in the time, but also ultimately to be free of all of this, just as we want to be free of all of it. So.
Right.
So I don't know if I've given you that much to work with, but nonetheless, hopefully
you failed. Thank you.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
Terrific. Thank you, Andre.
You're welcome.
Anyone else want to share anything or have a question?
I have a question. In a way, I've kind of been mulling it over in my mind. I know you were making a haphazard joke about hope. And what I've read about in Buddhism, hope kind of goes cyclical back into yourself, start with you first. But at the same time, I was thinking about, well, we cultivate bodhicitta in hopes to, isn't that in a way a version of hope, hoping for the better of humanity, hoping for the positive and less of the negative, even though I know you have both, and this life we're going to have both.
Sure.
And I'm like, I just wanted to see what you said about it. That's what I've been mulling over since we were talking about hope.
Sure. Thanks, Willis. Yeah, I think that it's definitely in the same vein. You know, when Joanna Macy and Chris Johnston put together this concept of active hope for the book, when I was reading it, I was sort of seeing it through that lens as well, of course, because of the conditioning I have around Tibetan Buddhism. But to me, it's what bodhicitta essentially is in the bodhisattva path, is this recognition that we are holding a view, a vision, an intention of what it is that we'd like the world to be. In a temporal way, but in the ultimate way of all beings attaining freedom from all their delusions, all their obscurations, attaining the perfection of their being. That's absolutely in the same vein as the sort of hope side of it. And the active side of it is absolutely the bodhisattva path as well. You know, the bodhisattva path is not one of sort of just, again, sitting in one's cave and, you know, being removed from the entire world and not doing anything to address the realities that people are dealing with. It's rolling up your sleeves and getting out there and, you know, doing everything that's involved. Venerable Rabinoff often points out how the Dalai Lama always says, you know, he likes a person of action, you know, likes people to just, you know, do things. And we really admire people in the world that do that. I know that when John Lewis died recently, I couldn't stop crying because you see in him that type of thing. He had a hope within him that was through the civil rights movement, but continued all the way through his life because he obviously saw that the work that he was dedicated to wasn't finished yet, you know. And that's, of course, what we all do in terms of our own bodhisattva path. Very few of us will finish the work in this life, certainly on ourselves, but we certainly won't finish the work in terms of the entire world and all the beings in it. But we stay active. I mean, John Lewis was always active, always doing what needed to be done and doing it with the proper mindset, which of course is what the bodhisattva path is very much about too. Because we recognize that if we do it with delusion and anger and all the other stuff, we're not going to get the results that we seek. So I absolutely agree with you, Willis. I think it is what bodhicitta is. It's just another name for it in a more secular context that they gave it, you know, that I think is really a nice way to look at it. I have two little things. Thank you. Was that good enough, Willis? Or did you?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, thank you for the question. Yeah. There are two things in the chat box. One says, my son was severely injured by a vaccine. There is a huge cover-up about the dangers of vaccines. The science of the dangers is plentiful. I hope you will research the Rush safety studies for the CV vaccine before deciding to take it. Thank you for that perspective. No, I think it is helpful. That's why, again, I'm sorry if I was sounding, you know, sort of anti-vaxxers. I wasn't meaning to make that sort of connotation. I think we have to, again, if we look back at what I was saying earlier in terms of that wider perspective, you have to be able to see the big picture. And so again, I appreciate you putting that out there and, you know, giving some voice to that side of it. And everyone, you know, again, doing what they can to research from their own point of view, making decisions accordingly. But, you know, when we get to the time of the vaccine, of course, in the, you know, with COVID virus, then, you know, the coronavirus, then I think, again, we'll have to each individually make decisions about that. And there, the decision a bit more, when we talk about the masks, they say, are essentially to protect others from you, whereas the vaccine tends to be to protect yourself from others, you know, and so it is a little bit different dynamics involved in that. And so, again, we may have different rationale for making that decision. And I appreciate you putting that out there. And then we have from Denise, thank you, Beth, for that question. From Denise, when I see someone not wearing a mask and I am walking past them on a path, I try to think, may you be well. I can be sincere in that wish, even from where I am now, since it will help me as well as them. I don't yet often recall this plan and the movement, but it's a start. Okay. So again, I think that it is good to always wish others well. You know, whoever, having a sort of a mind of bad intention towards anybody isn't fruitful. It doesn't lead to any positive results. You know, whoever we see, whatever decisions they make that we might disagree with or that we feel are wrong, and might get to some degree we feel that they're very wrong, we still hold that person in the light of that. We don't in any way, you know, not wish them well, because our wishing them well is a part of our spiritual development and a part of our staying connected to others. You know, we get into the bodhisattva path, and obviously we need people who challenge us and push our buttons and cause us to think in other ways to work with all the time. This is an important part of our path as well, you know, to just sort of live in our own little bubble, whatever our bubble might be, and think that everything is all fine within that. We're never going to grow spiritually. So I think, again, those challenging people by seeing them, by having, you know, something that we would normally get quite conflicted about, by actually sending out thoughts of loving kindness and thinking, may you be well. That's really one of the best ways to respond to that person. So thank you for sharing that, Denise. I think it is important that we have that as an active practice. That is part of our bodhisattva path, definitely. Anything else tonight? Okay. This is a lot. So again, I'll just briefly review. I would really encourage you, again, in looking at the trying times that we're in, to try to do some examination of changing your perspective, to try to see it in the most positive light through the various things we went through. Try to use your meditation, both your stabilizing and your analytical meditation, to keep going back to the Buddhist teachings and to the inner peace that we want to find in the midst of all of that. And then from that place of getting very clear about what our own intention is in the world, actively be involved in helping the world to heal and helping the world to grow and to develop, you know, not kind of getting timid in all of this, but rather becoming very courageous. That's how we make the best out of these trying times. And in my mind, that's the sanest response to these trying times, is to actually develop ourselves so we can better help others. So, okay, so I think that's enough for tonight. I'll turn it over to Donna, who's going to lead us in the concluding prayers.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you all. Oh, are you there, Donna?
Okay. All right. Let's say these in English tonight. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Just as the brave Manjushri and Sumantrabhadra too realize things as they are, I too dedicate all these merits in the best way that I may follow their perfect example. I dedicate all these roots of virtue with a dedication praised as the best by the victorious ones thus gone of the three times, so I might perform good works. And now short long life prayers for His Holiness the Dalai Lama. In a land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. And for Sarah J. Kinsa Rinpoche, just from Lobsang Delic, the one who masters speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatari, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama, ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. And for the long life of Kyabje Lama Zopa Rinpoche, you who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serves the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And for the long life of Geshe Gelug and Geshe Sanpo, Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha. 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 Trying to unmute you. There we go. Okay.
Keep muting and unmuting. Anyway, sorry, I muted myself with the prayers because sometimes it's a bit too echoey with too many people on at one time. So anyway, I was saying thank you all so much, and especially all of you who shared tonight. And I really do want us to kind of hold everyone in our hearts as we, you know, conclude tonight, making strong prayers of dedication for all of those that we know or are thinking of who are experiencing illness or obstacles, who have died or who are dying, whoever it is we're holding in our hearts. Send this positive energy out to them so they receive all the benefit from what we've done and find all the causes of happiness. So again, hold those thoughts in your heart, and I'll look forward to seeing you all for the weekend. Again, we'll start on Friday night from 7 to 9, and then Saturday and Sunday, 1 to 4, I think, your time. And looking forward to this. It's a really wonderful text. I've taught on it a few times, and I think it's, again, just kind of a nice way of encapsulating a lot of the different bodhisattva practices, but in very simple language and simple concepts, hopefully, not too complex. So we will get into emptiness, I promise. So, okay, blessings to you all. Good night. Stay safe. I'll see you soon. Okay.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Thanks, Donna.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks.